Hello and welcome to the Panorama Podcast from the World Business Council for Sustainable Development, or WBCSD. On this podcast, we talk about environment, economics, society, and just about any aspect of sustainability and how business and sustainability can act together. On today's show, we are joined by Judy Rogers. Judy is the General Manager for Corporate Communications and Sustainability at Mitsubishi Corporation Europe. Also on the pod is James Gomm, who has a foot in both camps as WBCSD's Social Impact Manager, seconded from Mitsubishi Corp. You're both very welcome. So Judy, I was told not to say that I have a Mitsubishi car or television or how I love your products. These come from totally separate companies to Mitsubishi Corp. They just share the same brand. Maybe you can tell us about Mitsubishi's unique history and how this all works.
Okay, so I do have an hour-long presentation that I could bore you with, but I won't this time. The Mitsubishi brand, I guess, is one that is quite complex and has a long history. So it was first established in the late 1800s, and it started as a small shipping family-owned company in southern Japan. And this grew into an industrial conglomerate up to the Second World War. However, shortly after the war, these big family-owned organizations were forced to split into separate and independent entities. So at that point, this big company was chopped up into 28 separate and independent companies. At that point, Mitsubishi Motors, the bank, Mitsubishi Heavy Industries, and others were formed. And our company was formed around that time as well. The Japanese name for our organization is Mitsubishi Shoji, which directly translated is Mitsubishi Trading. So essentially, we are a trade and investment B2B organization. May have confused you even more, but
no, that's perfect. So that's about 150 years of history in about 45 seconds, which is pretty good going. So you're with Mitsubishi Corp, and as you say, that's a trading company essentially, and totally separate from the car company or the electronics company.
Indeed, yeah.
And is there any connection there? Do you guys link up at all, or is it just the same as any two independent companies? Or
so formally, there is a little bit of cross-shareholding that still exists. And informally, there are some meetings, sort of brand reputation and communication sort of forums where people meet. The CEOs also meet up to talk about shared brand issues. But apart from that, we are completely financially and strategically independent. And quite often we're in competition with each other. So we are members of a family that have since gone on their separate ways.
Any family, not afraid to be in competition sometimes and work together in others.
Yes.
And you work for the European division of Mitsubishi, so you're based in London, is that correct?
I did start off in regional HR, and then I moved on to what was called CSR at the time in communications. And now that the concept of CSR, it's linked to sustainability, the approach by the company has changed and grown.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that about CSR, because this is an interesting area, sustainability CSR, where the entire perception of it has changed essentially over the course of the last couple of decades. What's been your take on that evolution of sustainability and CSR?
Yeah, I guess some 20 years ago, and I'll touch on our corporate foundation, the whole notion was of philanthropy, so companies doing good by giving money and perhaps at arm's length. And then also looking at the risk side, so environmental protection and standards and so on. So I think perhaps in the late 80s, early 90s, there was this, the companies were starting to think more seriously about their impacts and what the environmental considerations they needed to have. We started with looking at that perhaps in the late 80s, early 90s. In response to some degree to external campaigns, our discussions with NGOs, so it was a kind of defensive response, I guess, which has over the years grown into a much more proactive, positive commitment and responsibility as our business has grown and, you know, obviously our work has grown.
Mitsubishi in 1934 published three corporate principles, one of which was corporate responsibility to society, which is very impressive. Yes. I doubt there was many companies back in the 30s thinking about CSR or sustainability. But do you think that for this reason, Mitsubishi is a bit of a trailblazer in the area?
Well, there's always been a notion in Japan that companies exist for the benefit of society. So back then in the 30s, these principles were, you know, established by the Mitsubishi company as it was then. And many other Japanese companies had similar commitments, you know, public commitments. So I don't think we were necessarily unusual, certainly in Japan. But it's fantastic for us that we you know, obviously that we can claim to have those key core principles within the heart of our business for so many years. And I think we've, you know, experienced a sort of evolution of what that statement meant at that point in time and what it means now.
And where do you think sustainability is now? What are the main challenges at the moment for Mitsubishi Corp and sustainability in general?
Well, I guess broadly speaking, you know, we are a trade and investment organization. We handle everything from foods to natural resources to, you know, a very diverse range of businesses and investments. And for us, we must remain relevant going forward. We must look at new opportunities. So in the last 10, 15 years, many organizations, and we're not alone, you know, we were looking at the risk, the areas of risk that or the impacts that we as a business have on the environment and the world. But now we're looking forward and preparing ourselves for new ideas, innovation, new technologies. How can our business grow, adapt, and safeguard the world that we live in and live within the limits of the planet? So it's a case of continuous evolving to meet with the planetary boundaries.
And you spoke there about the risks and opportunities. What could you give an example of both a risk and an opportunity facing Mitsubishi Corp in this area?
I guess in terms of opportunity, for some time now, we've been looking at renewables. And that may be a sort of obvious opportunity going into the future. But, you know, it's increasingly important that we develop that part of our energy portfolio. And you know, it's critical that we look at the needs of communities around the world. So even though we're based in Japan, we're investing heavily in transmission in Europe and in the UK. So you know, that's one obvious area, I guess, of opportunity. In terms of risk, well, you know, we're looking at our current portfolio in terms of natural resources, looking to see whether you know, we need to adapt and change the focus of our investments.
Pivoting to you for a moment, James, you're WBCSD's social impact manager. And speaking of challenges, one thing at the moment is, for example, challenges such as automation, this links to globalization is under threat in some parts of the world. People are worried about areas like automation. From your own point of view, working in social impact and also having experience of Mitsubishi Corp, how do you feel global business is responding to these trends?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. I think what has emerged politically over the last few months to a year is a growing sense that there are growing social tensions out there, and that these are having real impacts in terms of political ramifications that are developing. What I would say is a real plus point at this sort of critical juncture is that we do have a gift that's been given to us in the form of the SDGs, which are Sustainable Development Goals, which highlights how we can put the world onto a pathway where nobody is left behind. And a lot of the social tensions that we've seen developing can be addressed through addressing critical environmental and social issues. And so the SDGs give us a pathway to follow up until 2030. And this is a pathway that is there for business and as it is there for governments and for other stakeholders. So I think for the first time ever, with business now has a clear direction that everybody can align with, not just the leading companies who've done a lot of work in these areas and are forging a path, is now a clear roadmap for everybody. So the challenge now for business is to think, what role does it have to play on this road and to contribute to that accordingly.
Yeah, and it feels like we are not at the beginning of this journey, but certainly more towards the beginning than the end. And if you take an area like, for example, long-term and quality jobs, which has been a key concern of quite a lot of groups over the past 12 to 18 months, do you feel that business is beginning to get a handle of how important this issue is and how it might respond to it?
Yeah, it's a tough area, and I think there's a lot of focus on the negative aspects that technology and automation are potentially going to throw up. I mean, obviously there will be a series of impacts as value chains become more automated on the jobs that are therein, but then huge growth areas in other areas of technology growth as you look to integrate technology into new products. As you have new markets developing, as you have new technology horizons that are emerging, it's also a huge growth area. So I think what is key for us is to be able to manage, measure, and understand exactly how business is interacting with the job market, what impacts these technologies are going to have, and then how we can respond to those to make sure that, you know, ultimately, business, technology, everything is there to try and enhance human welfare and to enhance our capacity as a society to progress and live well. So if a particular technological development is not doing that, then we have to question that development and how it's implemented. So I think business has a role to play, as do governments, in looking at how this space is evolving. So I think it's very exciting times, but also, you know, we have to look carefully at what's going on and make sure we're ahead of the curve.
Yeah, lots of challenges there. And going back to you, Julie, speaking about workers and organizations, there is a conversation at the moment about sustainability in organizations like Mitsubishi Corp and how over the past few years with developments like the SDGs, senior management have tended to really get on board with this. And this is what we've been seeing here as well. And it's a great trend. A separate thing is middle management or even new hires who mightn't be as adept at the SDGs and their importance to organizations as that senior management. And this is the next challenge in terms of getting large organizations to really push forward with sustainability. Does Mitsubishi Corp have a particular strategy, or how does Mitsubishi Corp deal with educating middle management to new hires and getting them motivated by sustainability?
Really good question. And, you know, we have over 70,000 employees, both within Mitsubishi Corporation's direct operations and in our investments. And so, you know, we have a huge challenge. Our Tokyo head office is taking great steps to look at that level of management and make sure they're equipped with the knowledge that they need. And we're also trying to do that from London office. And that's the key focus of my team at the moment. How can we better equip the people on the ground? Our CEO, our regional CEO, you know, proudly sports his SDG badge. He also has a lanyard that James brought back from the UN only a couple of weeks ago. You know, he is trying to influence and change the organization from a regional perspective. But it's also our job to really go out there and educate, provide people with the tools and the connections. And this is why, really, that, you know, James, he comes from my team, but he was seconded to WBCSD 18 months ago. And it's really, really critical that we have, you know, direct access to the work that WBCSD is doing in this way. You know, as a member before, of course, we had access, but it just makes such a difference to have you know, the finger on the pulse, as it were, through James. And he's very much a part of the program, coming back to train and talk to our staff across the region. So yeah, this is the big focus right now. How do we make sure that the knowledge that we have as a sustainability department is then, you know, filtered down into the business where it's needed. Mm. So I think we're not alone in this challenge, and it's a continuous work in motion.
Absolutely. And having people like James who go back to the business and impart that knowledge and become leaders essentially in this area is very important. But you mentioned there about trying to educate the rest of the business. What do you think is the best way to go about that?
Well, I think it is through collaboration. It's learning about what other companies, competitors, but as well as partners are doing in this space. It's really learning through looking at examples, at best practice. So just not just the sort of top-down training that you might imagine. It's really about giving people the sort of enabling people with knowledge and real-life examples of how other collaborations have really worked. And I think this is where the WBCSD and its experience is really helpful, useful, and inspirational sort of examples of how that collaboration can work in a non-competitive environment.
And finally, Judy, I was reading earlier about the Mitsubishi Corporation Fund for Europe and Africa. Again, going back to, you were very modest about it earlier, but this is something that Mitsubishi Corp are doing before a lot of other organizations globally, set up in 1992, around the same time as the Rio Climate Summit, when not business really, but even governments were really starting to take on this issue of environmentalism and climate change. Why were Mitsubishi motivated to set up this fund back in 1992, and what impact is it still having 25 years later?
Yeah, so I'll be honest. I think back then it was a defensive measure, a sort of a demonstration, if you like, that a company could do good. But many of its projects, whilst they were very worthwhile, it was the company trying to sort of at arm's length show that it was committed to various different causes around the world. And I'm not saying that that wasn't important at the time. And I think many other corporate foundations were established in the early 90s for a similar reason. But yes, the foundation has recently celebrated 25 years since it was first established. It's grown. It's become a vehicle to develop relationships to affect real change. It's a very different it has a different, very different remit to what it had at that time. So we're able to use the foundation as a means of really developing partnerships with NGOs, learning about critical issues to our business, and really trying to help in a small way. And I will remain sort of, I think we do need to be modest about this, because our foundation can't compete with the big foundations of this world, the Microsofts and the others. But we do like to develop regional partnerships that, provide value back to the business.
And do you think this is a common path for companies like Mitsubishi Corp to get involved in areas like this, maybe for defensive reasons, as you put it, or even pure reasons, but then once you get involved, you kind of stay involved and continue to work for other reasons?
I think corporate foundations that have been established during the last 10 years have a very different starting point. We've just come through the whole sort of evolution of foundations and find ourselves in a very different position today. But foundations, that have been established more recently have a very different sort of outlook and history or position or role within the company.
Thanks very much for dropping in, Judy. That was really, really fascinating. Covered a lot of areas there in a short amount of time. And thanks very much to you as well, James, for offering those words.
Thank you.
Thank you.